I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Dr. David Warmflash, author of The Moon, An Illustrated History, on the Jewish aspects of the closest heavenly body. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benecote. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week was quite a week for Jews here in America and perhaps everywhere. Immediately after services ended on the last day of Passover 8 days ago, we learned of the attack on the synagogue in Poway, California, in which a woman was murdered and the rabbi and two others wounded. The rash of such murderous assaults on synagogues, mosques, and churches in the last few months is horrifying and stunning. We are no longer shocked, sadly, but we have to respond. We were forced into a defensive mode of arranging special security meetings, learning better what to do and how to act in the event of an attack, and responding to concerned calls, texts, messages, and emails on a nonstop basis. It was the responsible way to act after the second murderous synagogue attack in 6 months in America. This one quite close to home for those of us in Arizona who often drive to San Diego on vacation. But it would seem close to home if it had occurred in any synagogue in America. And for rabbis and other congregational leaders, the only way to respond was to prepare and reassure Jews that it's safe to go to temple. You wonder, though, what kind of insane world is it where crazy men feel the need to walk into houses of prayer and slaughter innocent, unprotected human beings for no logical reason? It's no worse than seeing vicious, disturbed people attack schools, shooting or bombing indiscriminately and massacring children, but it's certainly no better. As my week continued with security briefings, establishing extra measures to protect people attending services and classes, yet another vigil of remembrance and an array of communications on all those subjects, I found myself remembering that 2 weeks ago my focus was buying extra Haggadot for our ever-growing Pesach Seder at my synagogue, preparing a class on Mishnah and Gemara, adding the right liturgy and readings and music for Shabbat and Passover services. Of course, I'd rather be doing that than trying to come up with the best words to explain what just happened in a Chabad shul in Poway, or figuring out from which direction an active shooter is likely to enter a synagogue building here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. After such a week, I come back to what I said after the Pittsburgh attack back in October, and again after Christchurch. We defeat hatred only by building respect, understanding, friendship, and meaning with those who are different from us, with all who pray sincerely. This attack was anti-Semitic, but it was also anti-Muslim, anti-Christian, anti-Hindu, anti-Buddhist, anti-Sikh. It was anti-religious, as each of these attacks has been. Victory over this kind of hatred comes only when we build new bridges, support one another, conquer ignorance with knowledge and inspiration. We must prepare for the worst, but more importantly, we must build towards the best within us. Celebrate what we share with those who are truly religious everywhere in the world, and especially right here, next door. The rabbi of that Chabad in Poway, Yisrael Goldstein, did a remarkable thing, and said a remarkable thing. First, after getting people away from the shooter in his sanctuary, he insisted on finishing his sermon outside the building, something I think very few of us would have done after having a finger shot off. And secondly, he said, terror will not win. Darkness is our enemy of all kinds. We must add more light to combat this evil darkness that's out there. Let us be the light and bring light and seek always to build understanding and respect with all who worship with sincerity. I pray that this is the last of these insane attacks, but I pray even harder that we answer this act of hatred by respecting those who pray in different ways than we do, by uniting with them actively to build a society and a world that celebrates and honors difference. To play us in this morning, here's a song that's kind of about exactly that. Yachad, an Israeli song that's now 20 years old, but still has great resonance. Yachad, together, heart to heart, will open and see the light in the sky. Together, heart to heart, will open with hope for love. Everything's possible. It's not too late. Dawn has risen already. It's time for love. Together, Yachad.
Yachad, lev elev, niftach v'nir'eh. Ta'ur sheba shamayim. Yachad, lev elev, niftach betikvah. La'ahava.
Ech she'alev niftach.
That was Yachad by Gaia Band. Together we can overcome darkness with light and hatred with love, with God's help and our own dedication. Our guest this morning, Dr. David Warmflash, knows more about the moon than anybody I know. He has a new book out that explores much about this heavenly body, including its many Jewish associations. It's called The Moon, An Illustrated History. Meet a real live astrobiologist. Find out what the moon teaches us when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball,
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Dr. David Wormflesh is the author of a new book, Moon, an Illustrated History from Ancient Myths to the Colonies of Tomorrow. It could not be more topical, both the Israeli Space IL mission and the 50th anniversary of the moon landing and so much. Welcome to Two Jewish. And since Judaism is a lunar-based calendar, you're right down our... absolutely down the alley.
Thank you for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. You're an astrobiologist. I have to ask you, what's an astrobiologist?
Well, astrobiology is the study of the origin, evolution, and distribution of life throughout the cosmos. I was actually one of the first cohort of astrobiology trainees at the NASA Johnson Space Center when NASA started the Astrobiology Institute.
Amazing stuff. Why did you decide to write Moon and Illustrated History?
It was actually was a serendipitous opportunity. My literary agent, Regina Brooks, was pitching a totally different book on a biomedical topic to different publishers. And this went on for about a year or more. And then she contacted me that there's a publisher who needs a book on an astronomy topic. And they needed an astronomer, and could you write about astronomy? And my reaction was, well, what kind of astronomy? Are we talking interstellar infrared astronomy, or are we talking something else? She says, well, it's about the moon. So it's basically planetary science, and that's up my alley. Planetary science is intermingled with astrobiology, so I was comfortable with that. And then they told me the format is part of the Illustrated History series, where you go part by part, 100 entries called milestones or moments in the history of whatever you're doing, and they needed it for the moon.
It couldn't have happened at a better time in so many ways. I want you to talk a little bit about the Jewish association with the moon, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's a very long association, and it started before Judaism. It started in ancient Sumeria in the 21st century BCE. It's really where you first get the organization under the third dynasty of Ur. And things were becoming so organized at the societal level that they needed a really good way to tell time. And different cities started using lunar calendars in a really, really organized way. And over the centuries, they gradually realized, well, we've got to change the amount of days in the month. Because there are two kinds of lunar months, really. There's the sidereal month, is it how long it takes the moon to go 360 degrees with respect to the fixed stars. You don't really notice that if you're looking up at the sky at the moon. What you do notice is the synodic month, which takes a couple of days longer. That takes about 29 and a half days, and it actually means that the moon has to go more than 360 degrees because during those first 27 days that it would be enough time for the sidereal month, Earth has moved more around the sun, so it's got to go more than 360 degrees to get back to the same position with respect to the line between the Earth and the sun. Then, in the time of Hammurabi, it got a lot more organized, and you had a systematic way for different cities to alternate between 29 days and 30 days. And then we get up to a time about 1,000 years later under a king, or maybe he was more like a governor, Nabonassar of Babylon, actually employed astronomers to do a systematic search of data that go way back through centuries, looking for trends in the data about the sun and the moon. And they found that every 235 lunar cycles, you get a repeat of the solar calendar, and that takes 19 years. And they organized a way to have
a calendar system, correct?
A calendar system with 12 years of 12 months, and then 7 years of 13 months. And that's going to sound very familiar to you because that eventually became the Jewish calendar. It was also called the Metonic cycle in ancient Athens by the mid 5th century, and then Samuel Bar Abba or Samuel Nehardea organized it into the Jewish calendar. He's pretty famous in the Talmud. He's known for, I think his famous saying was, I know the pathways of the planets through the sky,
right,
as well as I know the pathways of the roads in Hardea.
So, in fact, that's the origin of the Jewish calendar, and all of that complicated stuff explains why you need either a calendar or an app on your phone or Hebcal to figure out when the next holiday is.
So we just celebrated Pesach, and it's interesting to know that the first day in the Babylonian calendar was the first day of the Babylonian month of Nisanu. Does that sound familiar? That becomes the month of Nisan.
Nisan, of course, the springtime month, Chag HaAviv, absolutely. We will talk much more with David Warmflash when we come back, talking about Moon and Illustrated History, and we'll hear about Nazis and rockets to the moon and all kinds of stuff in just a moment when we return on To Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is currently located at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us this Friday night at Skyline and Campbell. We'll have Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m. with a delicious oneg after, and a special Saturday morning Shabbat hike and service at Catalina State Park, heading up to the Romero Pools afterwards starting at 8 a.m. It will be amazing. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, our rich array of adult education academy courses this week, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, www.BeitSimchaTucson.org, and on Facebook. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its wonderful beginnings. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akfel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's tojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, the Ukrainian elections took place, and there's now a 41-year-old Jewish president who was a comedian and played the president on TV. It's kind of crazy.
Right. There's also a Jewish prime minister. It's apparently the only country in the world outside of Israel to have both a prime minister and a president who are Jewish.
It's really stunning. Apparently there's a lot more Jews in Ukraine than we have been led to believe, but that's not really what prompted this. What prompted this was a belief that everybody was incredibly corrupt in Ukrainian politics, and this guy at least was clean.
Well, I think there is some reason to believe that most Ukrainian politicians are corrupt to one degree or another. I don't think that's a baseless belief. This guy was a TV stand-up comic who played the president, has no prior political experience, and as far as anybody knows, no proven record of corruption either. What's interesting is that Ukraine seems to be, at least on the surface, one of those countries that just teaches people anti-Semitism with their mother's milk.
They seem to grow in the soil there.
Right. And the national hero is a guy named Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who was famous for killing more Jews than anybody in history prior to Adolf Hitler. There are statues of him all over the country. Nobody's ever seriously suggested that those statues should be taken down or that his heroic role in Ukrainian history should be reexamined. But people say, in commenting on this election, that it's evidence that anti-Semitism is a less virulent force than it has been traditionally in Ukraine in the past, and that maybe the country's finally growing out of it. The ongoing armed conflict with the Russian Federation in the eastern parts of Ukraine may have something to do with redirecting fury toward the Jews to the direction of the Russians. I think that this Jewish guy who won is seen as Jewish by Ukrainians more than he is seen as Jewish by himself.
Now we're talking about Zelensky, of course, the new president, right?
Right. So
I always want to say Vladimir, but it's not pronounced how Ukraine. Volodymyr or something.
Volodymyr,
sorry.
Right. So it's not clear the extent to which he really identifies as a Jew or practices any form of Judaism actively, but he is certainly identified by his neighbors as a Jew. And there's also a longstanding tradition in Ukraine and in the former Soviet Union in general that all successful comedians are Jewish, speak with a Jewish accent. When they can, they imitate the accent of Odessa because that's supposed to be the funniest, because Odessa was once the biggest Yiddish-speaking city in the world. The new president is from a city which in Russian is called Kryvyi Rog, and in Ukrainian, Kryvyi Rih. And I have a former student who was a Peace Corps volunteer there. So that town is near and dear to his heart.
Fascinating. Well, good luck to new President Zelensky and Ukraine, which probably will need a little bit of luck. And it'll be fascinating to watch all this happen.
They'll both need luck.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Mr. and Mrs. Greenberg go to see the revival of Kiss Me, Kate that's on Broadway now. It's one of the sold-out shows of the year. Scalpers are retiring on their profits. Somehow they luck into orchestra seats in the middle of the fifth row, but they notice in the row behind them there's an empty seat. Intermission comes, no one's sitting there. Mrs. Greenberg turns to the woman sitting next to the empty seat and asks, "Pardon me, this is a sold-out show in such demand. We're wondering why that seat is empty, do you know?" The woman says, "Oh, that's my late husband's seat." Mrs. Greenberg's embarrassed, apologizes for being insensitive. But a few moments later, she turns around again. "Look, I don't mean to be rude or anything, but this is a really hard show to get into. Surely you must have had a friend or relative who would have wanted to take your husband's seat and see the show." And the woman nods but explains, "Yes, but they're all at his funeral." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our young representatives of Israel, Ron Benakot and Rotem Rappaport. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So there's an interesting festival that's a combination holiday coming up this week. Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzmaut, the Israel Memorial Day, and then the Independence Day. It's a really interesting combination the way it happens in Israel. You can't really recreate that here in America, but maybe you can explain your experience of it.
So for me, every year, it's really hard to make that transition because on Yom HaZikaron, Memorial Day, you remember everything that happens and you appreciate the people that fought for Israel and the IDF and were in wars and just protected Israel. And then a few hours later, you go to the street and celebrate the independence, which I see why they did it like that. I mean, we remember the people that because of them, we have a country. And we need to celebrate that, but still that transition sometimes could be really hard.
Yeah, it's really, it is kind of crazy. You have the big siren, right? Which rings for, what, 2 minutes or something? A really long time.
Yeah, in Yom HaZikaron, it's 1 minute in the evening and 1 minute in the day. And in Yom HaShoah, it's two minutes
for Yom HaShoah. I always get confused which way. Thank you. And then, you know, it's very somber. And of course, you're not just remembering those who fought, you're remembering those who died, right? So it's really powerful. And then you got to go celebrate, like, immediately after. If you were to design it, how would you have done it? Would you separate them by more?
I think that, like Ron said, I can really see the symbolic thing of doing it day after day. And I think that people are, like, there are people who really strongly believe that that's how it should happen. But there's also a lot of people that we need to remember that lost their loved ones. And they have a really hard time celebrate Yom HaTzmaut right after they had a day to remember their loved ones. I think that we should be more appreciative of them and be more like sympathetic for them.
Sure.
And even though it's a symbolic thing that I think is important, I think it's more important that we can all celebrate and not leave the ones who still have their remembers behind.
What did you guys do for Yom HaAtzmaut, for the celebration of Israel's Independence Day in your community? What was the big thing?
So there is something called Bamot, and it happens in every city. It's just like a carnival kind of thing, and there are shows of famous artists in Israel. So I used to go every year with my cousins. It was so fun. You get like treats, you know, like those candy apples, and you just listen to music, and it's just fun with your friends, with your family.
And lots of flags everywhere, yes. Lots of blue and white. So obviously for Yom HaTzmaut, you say Chag Sameach, right? It's a holiday. What exactly. Do you say for Yom HaZikaron? Is there a phrase? You really don't.
Yeah, it's just like you respect.
It's funny, in some ways it encapsulates Israel, right? To have come from Yom HaShoah last week, Holocaust Remembrance Day, then you move to the Memorial Day, and then the celebration. It's sort of like all of Jewish history encapsulated in a week or so.
Exactly.
Very powerful. Thanks so much, guys. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Kedoshim, which includes the Holiness Code, a description of the ethical injunctions that lie at the heart of Jewish practice. The code itself includes mitzvot that require us to assist the poor, treat strangers, widows, and orphans with generosity and kindness, insists on fair business practices. It obligates us to live moral lives. It's important that this remarkable section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Kedoshim, the Holiness Code, is in the middle of the middle of the Torah. That is, it forms the heart of the heart of our most sacred text. And at that heart is the ethical injunction to love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is an amazing, perhaps utopian ideal. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself? If our society was actually rooted in such a conception, how much better it would be for everyone. You know, in the wake of the attack on the Chabad synagogue in Poway, California last week, the idea of loving one's neighbor as oneself may seem particularly visionary. How can we believe in such a concept in a world in which horrible human violence can invade a house of prayer? Can the ideal possibly be made real? But in true Jewish fashion, Kedoshim does not treat this as simply an idealistic statement. It's instead made into a practical imperative. Kedoshim builds up to this magnificent religious commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of your field for the poor and stranger. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow and orphan. Be honest in your business dealings. Have equal weights and measures. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical because that is at the heart of holiness. The way to love your neighbor is by treating him or her fairly and honestly. It is that notion of the pragmatic approach to love that is just so Jewish. We are not obligated to convert our neighbors to our own views on things. We are not obligated to save our neighbors from their own belief systems. We are not obligated to change our neighbors into carbon copies of ourselves. But we are commanded to treat them as we would wish to be treated, respectfully, honorably, honestly, charitably, even generously. That is love of one's neighbor as expressed in a functional, healthy society, or community, or synagogue. May we learn that great lesson this week. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, David Warmflash, will explore what the 50th anniversary of the moon landing will mean this summer and tell us just what the Israeli lunar landing accomplished, even after its ultimate disappointment. And, oh, fill us in on Wernher von Braun. Find out all of that when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Poway, California, northern San Diego County, a 19-year-old with an AR-15 rifle attacked the Chabad Center during services on the last day of Passover. One congregant, Lori Kay, was murdered. The rabbi, Yisrael Goldstein, had a finger shot off and was wounded in his other hand as well, and two others, including an 8-year-old girl, were also wounded. The shooter's gun jammed, or there would have been many more casualties. The killer was chased from the synagogue, and an off-duty Border Patrol officer shot his vehicle. He was apprehended shortly thereafter by police. He faces murder charges, terrorist assault charges, and hate crimes charges. His family has disavowed the 19-year-old, who posted anti-Semitic comments and threatened to kill Jews shortly before the attack. He apparently also committed arson earlier on a mosque. He is also apparently a Dean's List student. Rabbi Goldstein, the rabbi in this awful incident, was notably brave. In spite of the shock and loss of blood from his wounds, he helped shepherd everyone to safety. And then, once the blood loss had been stopped, he spoke in front of the synagogue for about 15 minutes, decrying hate, asking his congregants to be the light in a world shrouded in darkness. President Donald Trump placed a condolence call to Rabbi Goldstein of Chabad of Poway after the incident. He spoke about his love of peace and Judaism in Israel, Rabbi Goldstein said, adding that the call lasted 10 to 15 minutes. He was amazed to hear from an American president. He was so comforting, the rabbi said. Coming in the wake of the Pittsburgh Tree of Life shooting in October, the Christchurch mosque bombings in March, and the Sri Lanka church and hotel murders on Easter Sunday in April, this marks yet another brutal and unprovoked attack on people at prayer. This horrible incident, as I said to my own congregation, Beit Simcha, is definitely anti-Semitic, but it is also anti-Christian, anti-Muslim, anti-Buddhist, anti-Sikh, anti-Hindu, anti-religious in every sense. We have a lot of work to do to fix a society where it seems acceptable to some to brutally attack people at prayer. In other news, President Trump decried the rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes and referenced the shooting attacks on the synagogues in Poway and Pittsburgh in a proclamation for Jewish American Heritage Month in May. As we observe Jewish American Heritage Month, our nation celebrates nearly 4,000 years of Jewish history and honors the numerous contributions of Jewish Americans to our country and world, read the proclamation. All Americans bear a moral responsibility to stand alongside our Jewish communities and learn the lessons of tolerance that run through the tragedies that have befallen the Jewish people both long ago and sadly in recent times. Reflecting on these events steels our resolve that they never happen again. As Americans, we unequivocally condemn the pernicious, baseless hatred that is anti-Semitism. Representative Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, in her statement marking Jewish American Heritage Month, said the Jewish community's vibrant culture and rich traditions enrich our lives, enhance our society, and help build a brighter future for all Americans. Every day, Jewish Americans' ingenuity, creativity, courage, and determination strengthen our communities and honor our most cherished values. All Americans must come together in the spirit of unity to disavow bigotry in all its forms, remembering that freedom, justice, and equality are the guiding principles that protect our nation and our democracy, wrote Pelosi. As we mark Jewish American Heritage Month, we will continue to work tirelessly to honor our nation's diversity, protect Jewish communities, and safeguard the right of every religion to practice their faith freely and proudly. In other news, a majority of Jewish Americans have positive feelings about Muslims, and the feelings are mutual, according to a survey released last week. The 2019 American Muslim poll conducted in January found that 53% of Jewish Americans report positive views of Muslims, highest of any non-Muslim faith group surveyed, compared to just 13% with negative views. The same percentage of Jews reported that a candidate's endorsement of a Muslim ban would decrease their support for that individual. Likewise, 45% of the Muslim American respondents had favorable views of Jews, while just 10% reported negative views. The remaining respondents were neutral. Personally knowing a Muslim may contribute to the positive sentiment. 76% of Jewish American respondents said they knew a Muslim, compared to just 54% of the general public. And 45% of the Jews said they are close enough with a Muslim that they would call them if they needed help. Among white evangelicals, as many as 44% held unfavorable opinions about Muslims, more than double those with favorable views, just 20%. The poll was commissioned by the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, a research and advocacy organization for Muslim Americans. Among the 2,376 respondents, 804 identified as Muslim, 360 as Jewish. Finally, all 181 Palestinians who requested entry to Israel in order to take part in the joint Israeli-Palestinian Memorial Day peace event in Tel Aviv were denied entry, the Defense Ministry in Israel announced. The reason given for the rejection was the closure imposed on the West Bank on Yom HaZikaron, Israeli Memorial Day, even though Palestinians have been permitted to take part in this event in past years, even when there was a closure. Israeli-Palestinian Bereaved Families for Peace and Combatants for Peace, the two organizations organizing the event, will petition the High Court of Justice in Israel about the decision. Last year, the Israeli High Court ordered the Israeli government to allow the Palestinians entry after their request was similarly denied. The Israeli-Palestinian Memorial Day ceremony began as a celebration for 50 people in 2005. According to Combatants for Peace, it has grown. It was started by Buma Inbar, whose son was killed in Lebanon in 1995, together with other peace activists and combatants for the peace movement. It has become a joint event with the Israeli-Palestinian Bereaved Families for Peace. The organization's theme is "War is not an act of fate, but a choice of man." In 2017, 4,000 people attended the event, while hundreds stood outside. A parallel event with 600 more people took place in Beit Jala in the West Bank. Other events were held in Kiryat Tivon, in Berlin, Germany, Switzerland, the U.S., the U.K., and other countries. Protests against the event took place after the 2017 event. The attendance in Israel was up to 7,000 Israelis and Palestinians last year, 2018. The theme was "Remembering Our Future Together." Protests were held outside that year's event, too. The 2019 event this year, the theme will be "Sharing Sorrow, Bringing Hope." It will take place May 7th. That's the 2 Jewish News of Jews Around the World. To welcome back our guest, here's a classic song by Tom Lehrer, the great Jewish political parodist of the 1960s, his tune about Werner von Braun.
Gather round while I sing you of Werner von Braun, a man whose allegiance is ruled by expedience. Call him a Nazi, he won't even frown. Nazi schmatzi, says Werner von Braun. Don't say that he's hypocritical, say rather that he's apolitical. Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Werner von Braun. Some have harsh words for this man of renown, but some think our attitude should be one of gratitude, like the widows and cripples in old London town who owe their large pensions to Werner von Braun. You too may be a big hero once you've learned to count backwards to zero. In German or English, I know how to count down. And I'm learning Chinese, says Werner von Braun.
We welcome back to 2 Jewish our guest this morning. David Wormflash is the author of the book Moon, An Illustrated History. He's a scientist, author, scholar, active Jew. So we talked a little bit about the origin of the lunar calendar and how it became the Jewish calendar. We are so connected to the cycles of the moon. Let's shift a little bit and talk about, you know, exploring the moon, getting up there, how all of that became so central, and some colorful figures who were involved in that.
Well, it really started in the context of the Cold War, but the technology for that to happen developed during the 20th century. And all started with who's called the father of astronautics, is Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who was Russian, who was inspired by Jules Verne, a book, De la Terre à la Lune, and going from Earth to the Moon in the 19th century. And that led through the early years of the 20th century until you get up to a lot of progress in Europe. There was some progress in the United States under Robert Goddard, but the only people who were paying attention to him, unfortunately, were the Nazis as they read his material.
And the Nazis paid very close attention. You know, Wernher von Braun, other Nazi scientists who developed their rocket program. After the war, when the Nazis, you know, managed to send lots of rockets into England, but didn't quite get to nuclear capability, thank God, a lot of those scientists were spirited away either by the Russians or by the Americans, right?
Yeah, actually, the Nazis were not close at all to nuclear weapons. They were far off. They were going in the wrong direction, luckily.
Huh.
But they were really advanced in rocket technology. Von Braun was actually part of the second generation of rocket scientists. It really started with people like Hermann Oberth, who advised on a film called Frau im Mond, the woman in the moon, in the 1920s.
Right.
He was a Hungarian, I think, Transylvanian. And it led to von Braun, because von Braun was this kind of young teenage genius in the Weimar Republic. He wasn't a Nazi at first. He was just a guy who loved rockets and had a dream about getting people into space, getting people to the moon, getting them to Mars, and he was part of a rocket club. And he was swooped up by the German military, but when the Nazis took over, then the Wehrmacht took over the whole program, and von Braun was in the program, and it was a choice of, well, we put you in jail or you work for us, and we can help you with your space dream. They didn't care about space. They cared about how to carry bombs. And this led him to develop what's called the Aggregate 4 rocket that eventually came to be known as the V2, V for victory, for vengeance, sorry.
So after the war, von Braun is kind of gobbled up by the OSS. How all did that work out?
Well, there was called originally Operation Overcast. Later on, it was changed to Operation Paperclip. And President Truman issued an order that the OSS was to check everybody's background, and all these German specialists that were being swooped up. The motivation was that the Soviet Union was doing the same thing, and the Americans knew they'd be going up against the Soviet Union the second the war ended, and they were scared. And Truman's order was, any hint of war crimes, you should be sending them over to Nuremberg, and you did not bring them to the United States. But in practice, that didn't really happen. They looked the other way. And there were different experts that were taken up by the Americans and by the British. It was actually the British who got General Dornberger, who was in charge of the whole thing. And they were transferred to secret locations in the United States so they could develop rocket technology. And a lot of these guys ended up in NASA working for the space agency, including von Braun. And there was, I'd say, a spectrum of how involved they were, how committed they were to the Nazi ideal. Von Braun himself, he wasn't ideologically a Nazi, but he went along with it. That's where he was. There was an aerospace historian who wrote a biography of von Braun, who said that he sleptwalked into a Faustian deal. That's how he described him. But the state of his conscience is very unknown. He made a famous remark about, well, the rockets that were, meaning the ones that were launched against Antwerp and London, they worked really well, but they landed on the wrong planet. He really wanted to go to other planets, but he wasn't willing to stop at anything at all to get his way. And so he accepted the Nazi funding and eventually also a commission into the SS. He joined the Nazi Party in 1938. And they basically invited him, I'm using air quotes. Well, but there were others who were ideologically committed to the Nazis. Now, Arthur Rudolph, who became the project leader of the NASA Saturn V program, in the 1980s, he had to leave the United States because investigations in the 1980s found that he was a committed Nazi who joined the Nazi Party in 1931. Hmm. So that would be like joining Donald Trump in 2012.
Right.
So... Not to compare the two, but it's just...
No, but it's jumping on the bandwagon very early.
Very early, which shows your enthusiasm. Now, when the Americans came in there, and also when the Soviets came in, they found that there was a factory called the Middleburg Factory, which was carved into a mountain. The Nazis had moved the V-2 program here from Peenemünde, which had been bombed by the British. And in the Middleburg, they were using slave labor from the Dora concentration camp system. And they found in the 1980s that Rudolph had come up with the whole idea of using the slave labor. Just, I know what we could do. Let's use slaves. Von Braun, he's kind of in between. They found his signature on some documents, and later he admitted that he had witnessed the condition in the tunnel mountain. And he just felt that he was trapped, he had nothing to do, I was just following orders, like just like the song that you played. It's kind of like that. I don't really know what to do. I want to get people into space. I don't want them to kill me. But it turns out that something like 9,000 people were killed from the bombings by V-2s in London and Antwerp, but an estimated at minimum 20,000 people were killed of the slaves working on the rockets because of the conditions.
Wow. Horrifying. That never seemed to trouble von Braun later in life, did it?
Yeah.
I want to look a little bit at the Space IL experience because you have more insight into kind of what happened. It was unbelievable that this tiny nation, Israel, the only other countries that have ever landed anything on the moon, were the United States, Russia, and China. America, of course, the only manned landing, human personed landing 50 years ago. Now, almost. Space IL got a lot of publicity, but it kind of snuck up on a lot of people. Tell us about what it really accomplished, because, of course, the end wasn't so great, and maybe about that a little bit, too.
First of all, the whole thing only cost $100 million, which for landing something on the moon is nothing compared with...
Doesn't NASA lose that much in spare change every week, kind of?
Yeah, well, right now, unfortunately, the NASA budget is not so good. Like, it's right. Less than 10% of what it was at the height
it's
of
heyday,
the Apollo
right.
program.
Right.
But if, first of all, let's have some perspective here. It is really hard to get to the moon, just to hit it. The first landing ever on the moon was a crash landing on the moon,
right.
A harder crash landing than the Space IL, the Barishit probe, ended up making. So in 1959, the Soviet Union landed, again, I'm using air quotes, they impacted the moon with the Luna 2 probe. And it was celebrated. Look what we did. We got something to touch the moon. And so now the Israelis just did that. It almost landed. It was an engine. There was an engine cut off because of a computer glitch. And they were able to start everything off. And the last contact that they had with Barishit was about 150 meters over the surface. And unfortunately, they couldn't get enough delta V to slow down enough to prevent crash, and that seems to be what happened. But it was a big deal to get there. Also, it went into orbit. Hard to get into orbit around the moon, especially with such a shoestring budget. But it would have been a nice science mission. They were publicizing the whole educational angle and inspiring children. They never really talked too much about what they were going to do. They had one instrument. They didn't talk too much about it. It was a magnetometer, and it was going to study the magnetic environment of that part of the moon, which is the area where the first human landed, came down, which would give a lot of insight about the origins of the moon. And the principal investigator who communicated with me a little bit, Oded Aronson of Mahon Weizmann in Rehovot, he
he is actually a pretty prominent figure in the issue of where did the moon come from, which he's an advocate of, really the initiator of what's now come to be known as the multiple small impact hypothesis, which is competing with a more popular idea called the giant impact hypothesis, which posits that the moon started when a Mars-sized planet crashed into the young Earth, and a lot of the material, almost all the iron went to the Earth, which is why Earth has such a strong magnetic field, and only a little bit went to the moon. And there's a lot of uncertainty about that, a lot of it coming from samples that were collected by astronauts on the Apollo 15 and Apollo 17 missions, showed that there's water deep, deep inside the minerals of certain pyroclastic ash samples. And this wasn't known until about 10 years ago, when we had the technology to look really close at those samples. And if there's water that deep into the rocks, it doesn't really go along too well with the idea that both planets were almost pulverized completely, because they would have heated up so much that all volatiles like water would have been lost. And so this kind of pushes things a little bit toward the Odette Aronson hypothesis. But it's highly debated right now.
Well, it's, you know, the whole space IL thing has been inspirational. And I sort of like what Prime Minister Netanyahu said, if at first you don't succeed, although I'm not sure they're about to launch another lunar lander anytime in the near future. It's still an amazing experience. David, the book is called Moon and Illustrated History. I feel like we just kind of scratched, forgive me, the surface. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the
book?
Well,
it's coming out in just 2 days on May 7th. So if you're going to order it online, you can just go ahead and order it, and it won't change how long it'll take to get it. And it'll be in the brick and mortar stores on the 7th, and in all the main stores, and Barnes and Noble and independent bookstores. They all have it. And Amazon, if you really want to help me, you help me on Amazon if you bought a lot of space and astronomy books. That helps with the algorithm to get it into the right category. And if you usually don't buy science books, go buy it at the brick and mortar store, but buy it anyway.
Well, and I hope it goes straight to the moon. Forgive me. listen, Chag Sameach, happy Cinco de Mayo. And,
Chag Sameach and happy Cinco de Mayo.
It's a pleasure having you.
Yeah.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final moon-oriented playout here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball,
enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Stephen Waldman, co-founder of BeliefNet, author of the new book, Sacred Liberty, America's Long, Bloody, and Ongoing Struggle for Religious Freedom. Our playout this morning comes for Israeli Independence Day next week, Yom HaAtzmaut. It's from Israeli pop star Eden Ben-Zakein, and it's called Brit Olam, Eternal Covenant. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
על המחר ואתמול ואלינו שומר במצולות קראתי אלוקי אתה שומע בוחן הלבבות בכל דקה בכל שנייה אתה נמצא כאן אני מרגישה איך מכולם אתה שמרת לנו ברית עולם שמור עליי שפויה עם רגליים דפוקות לדם בזכותך עוד יש לי אוויר לנשימה פותח ידיו לרווחה ומברך אותנו בכל יום שעובר בצור לא קראתי אלוקי אתה שומע בוחן הלבבו בכל דקה בכל שנייה אתה נמצא כאן אני מרגישה
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.